This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Are there important jobs going begging in Michigan? Jobs that fall under the umbrella of STEM jobs, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics-based jobs? Well, it's accepted virtually everywhere that STEM jobs are crucial for innovation and economic growth. A major study in 2011 by Georgetown University examined the importance of these STEM jobs, and it projected by 2018 there'll be 2.4 million job openings for workers with STEM degrees, and it predicts American businesses won't be able to fill the openings with U.S. graduates alone. My next guest believes that one important way to help fill those jobs in engineering, math, computer science, design, building and construction, physical sciences, and more would be to lower the barriers keeping immigrants with this vital STEM talent from coming here to America. Susan M. is an immigration attorney in Grand Rapids. Her recent piece in the Grand Rapids Business Journal asked the question, do immigration barriers stifle entrepreneurship and our vital STEM workforce? She's also the chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association Michigan chapter, and Susan joins us now from Grand Rapids. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Well, that Georgetown study, Susan, looking at education and jobs, really seemed very clear that our education system is not turning out enough STEM-capable students to meet those demand for those traditional STEM jobs or the kinds of jobs that would demand the core skills and competencies that STEM workers possess. So you would argue that letting in more immigrant STEM workers wouldn't take jobs away from American workers?
I would, because I work with U.S. employers, many of them Michigan employers, on a regular basis, Cynthia, to obtain the work visas for these highly skilled foreign nationals. And I know from my experience that these U.S. employers would love to fill the positions with U.S. grads. It certainly would be less time-consuming. They could cut out the bureaucratic headaches of dealing with our immigration service, and they wouldn't have to pay immigration attorney fees. But they don't have a choice. There just aren't enough U.S. grads or skilled workers to fill the positions.
How does that, in your view, impact the economic recovery of Michigan and really the prospects for future growth?
Well, Cynthia, you may have heard, you know, our own Governor Snyder, you know, talking about, you know, being really the most pro-immigrant governor in the United States, and I really admire his stances that he's taken on immigration, you know, given that this has been such a hot-button topic. But I would tell you that immigrants create jobs. You don't have to look much further than, you know, our history of these Google, Intech, eBay. I mean, these are household American brands and names, and they were founded by immigrants or the children of immigrants. So we've got, in Michigan alone, 33% of our tech companies were founded by immigrants, and that's just a really vital statistic that we can't afford to ignore.
So it sounds like there would be a twofold benefit. One, that existing companies would be able to have the STEM-based workers, STEM-skilled workers that they need, and also that these folks coming in kind of possess that entrepreneurial drive. So you'd also be creating new companies and therefore new jobs.
Exactly. It's both.
Well, some critics argue that foreign-born STEM workers are driving American workers out of those jobs because those foreign nationals would accept lower wages. How do you answer that?
Well, I would first answer that it's a myth, because number one, the folks that we are working with these U.S. employers, many of them Michigan employers, again, they're not doing this because they want to do it. They don't want to go through a very laborious and expensive U.S. immigration process just to do it. They're doing it because they have to do it. And as part of that process, Cynthia, there are minimum prevailing wage requirements that U.S. employers must meet in order to even petition for these foreign national workers. So I would argue right then and there, you can't get away with it. You can't pull the wool over DOL and USCIS's eyes in terms of being able to pay these foreign nationals what they have to be paid, what similarly situated U.S. workers are being paid. Of course, there are always bad apples or people that aren't playing by the rules in any segment of the population, but the statistics show that the amount of fraud that's happening, for instance, in the H-1B work visa arena is extremely low.
And when we talk about these types of jobs that are needed by workers with STEM skills, what kinds of jobs are we talking about?
You know, it's really quite wide-ranging, Cynthia. Mm-hmm. Gone are the days where it's just simply the researchers and the scientists. It's really broadened, and what we're contacted by U.S. employers for work visas and green cards are for, you know, STEM occupations that really go beyond that traditional research scientist. Of course, we still have those requests, but we also have requests for architects and all sorts of computer IT specialist positions, ranging from systems analysts to database analysts to programmers and software engineers.
You talk in your piece about the immigration barriers. So
yes.
Give us some specific sense of what these barriers are. How, in your view, is the current immigration system broken?
There's a couple of things that some folks may have heard about. We have, you know, the most common professional specialty occupation work visa is known as the H-1B. It sounds like a disease, but it's not. We only have 65,000 slots available per fiscal year, with only 20,000 additional slots allocated for people that hold U.S. master's degree. Those slots run out so quickly after they become available. In fact, last year they ran out, I think, 10 weeks after they became available. And we all know that this year it's going to be even worse. And so right then and there we can see that if these type of H-1Bs that are used a lot by STEM workers or folks with STEM core competencies, because we're not graduating enough U.S. Students to fill those type of positions, they're just being used up too ridiculously quickly. And with employers having to pay major premium fees to the government just to file an H-1B, they don't want to do this if they didn't have to do it. And when we're seeing them run out so quickly, that's a major barrier. But there are other major barriers that you may not have heard of, folks may not have heard of. We're dealing right now with a culture of no at our U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service centers, despite the talk about comprehensive immigration reform that's becoming very popular in D.C. right now, and that's encouraging. A lot of folks do not know how difficult it is for U.S. employers legitimately needing to bring over, whether it's their highly skilled managers and executives from abroad, from a corporately related entity, or it's folks trying to petition for a highly skilled STEM worker.
What do you think is behind the culture of no? Give us some for instances.
Oh boy, the downturn of the economy. We have seen a very protective attitude from some of the officers at USCIS. And while we understand where that is coming from, that is not their role. Their role is to decide whether or not an employer meets the legal requirements for that particular work visa category under the statute and regulations, not we've got these issues with our U.S. economy, and this person is on its face just not eligible to come because they're going to take a job away from a U.S. worker. That attitude, that protective attitude, is bleeding into the decisions, and we're seeing some very poorly written decisions coming from USCIS on work visa petitions, where these are employers just banging their heads against a wall saying, if I could hire a U.S. worker, Susan, I would. I can't. And they've done, some of them, significant recruitment efforts that we document in the filings of the petitions to the government, just to show them.
We should also note that when we refer to the USCIS, it's the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Those service centers are kind of the place. It sounds like you're feeling that the logjam is happening. What's a typical wait? How long might some of these foreign nationals who have these STEM skills wait to be able to get the green card status and get that visa?
Well, boy, green card status is a whole nother issue, but I would tell you that they are waiting a very long time. Assuming the STEM worker or the entrepreneur is lucky enough to be approved for a work visa, which can take several months. If they're lucky, it might be less than that, but it can also take several months, assuming that it even gets approved. Once they're here, in order to keep them here, the employer...
What's a typical cap, Susan?
Yeah, for an H-1B, it's 6 years.
Okay.
For an L-1 intra-company transfer of a manager or executive, it would be 7 years. The only way to keep that valued foreign worker here is to pursue a very laborious green card process. And so circling back to your question, Cynthia, some of these foreign nationals, particularly those that are born in India and China, they are waiting 5, 8, 10-plus years to attain green card status, and oftentimes we're losing some of those foreign nationals to countries with more competitive immigration laws because they just don't want to stick around and wait, or their spouses and their children have no ability to get work authorization while they're waiting out this very long time frame.
Susan M., as an immigration attorney, what solutions would you be calling for, first of all, in terms of reforming our visa system?
Well, you know, you hit it right on the button, Cynthia. The first thing we need to do is, you know, while security is important, building more walls isn't going to solve this problem. We need better laws. We need to take a look at this particular STEM population and the entrepreneurs that are looking to come here, invest in the United States, and create jobs. We need to have a legal visa category that's created for entrepreneurs and investors, aside from our one category that we have, known as an E2 visa category, which isn't even available to all countries, particularly India and China. So we need visa categories that are targeted toward these highly qualified individuals who are proven entrepreneurs, proven folks that create jobs.
In terms of just the way that we as American citizens, as citizens of Michigan, view these immigrant workers, these foreign nationals, what would you like to see changed in that?
I would love to see, in fact, I feel that our economic recovery and success in Michigan and everywhere in the United States is dependent on a fresh view of immigrants, not looking at it as a we versus them. It can be win-win, particularly if you look at the contributions of immigrants.
Susan M. is an immigration attorney in Grand Rapids. Her recent piece in the Grand Rapids Business Journal entitled, "Do Immigration Barriers Stifle Entrepreneurship and Our Vital STEM Workforce?" And we have put links to your article and also to that major study done by Georgetown University examining the importance of these STEM jobs and the need for workers with these core STEM skills. Susan, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, hands up. How many of you read The Little House books by Laura Ingalls Wilder? Well, my hand is up. I can tell you from the time my third grade teacher, Mrs. Syme, began reading us Little House in the Big Woods, I was totally hooked. And those of us who read those books, who can forget opening up by the shores of Silver Lake and reading these words? Here's the quote. "Mary and Carrie and baby Grace and Ma all had scarlet fever. Far worst of all, the fever had settled in Mary's eyes and Mary was blind." Dr. Beth Tarini read those words when she was a little girl, and she remembered them years later when she was in medical school, and that set her on some medical detective work. The assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Michigan is making headlines all over the nation as she published a report in the journal Pediatrics with what she believes really made Mary Ingalls go blind. And Dr. Beth Tarini joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Well, it's obvious that that stunning beginning of By the Shores of Silver Lake stuck in your mind as well. And what, it was a conversation with one of your med school professors that got you thinking what?
Thinking, how could this be, on both sides. So I, like many medical students, was sitting around a table going through my pediatrics clerkship, and we were talking about scarlet fever. And I just raised my hand and said, oh, scarlet fever can make you go blind, right? And the professor sort of stopped and said, no, I don't think so. I've never seen that before and never heard of it. And I said with such certainty, well, but Mary Ingalls went blind. And I had read the books and it had come back to me. And it obviously, as you say, resonated with me and
yes.
It stayed with me. And you can see the professor sort of knew of the story and hesitated because knew Mary Ingalls was also a real person.
Right.
And said, I still don't think so. But I wasn't satisfied with that answer and so went off my own to find out what really happened.
So you did medical detective work. What,
yes.
what did you do?
So I went wandering around the stacks of the medical school, looking, dusting off and old medical textbooks from the era, trying to find out if, in fact, there had ever been reports or descriptions of scarlet fever causing blindness. And I'd find occasional reports of blindness, but it was often temporary, rarely permanent. At the same time, I was looking into the source for the book and then uncovered the fact that these books, as many know, are autobiographical fiction and are based on memoirs,
right.
Which themselves are written years later. And so then went to the original memoirs called Pioneer Girl to find what had Laura penned initially before those books were even published.
And what had she written?
She had written about an experience in which Mary goes blind, and she writes with, first of all, much more detail than what you see in the book.
Sure.
And she also writes with a notable absence and presence of symptoms which are not in the book. For example, there is no mention of a rash. In addition, she writes about a fever, and she writes about a headache. The headache doesn't come into the book at all. And interestingly enough, she writes about a stroke, what she calls a stroke, describing then that one side of Mary's face droops, which is interesting for numerous reasons. First, not necessarily a common association one would put with scarlet fever. Second, the stroke is not necessarily itself a common association with a febrile illness. Interestingly enough, when you go to the newspapers of that time, you find that, in fact, she, in local newspapers, was written to have a stroke. But when you look at the actual description, right, what they call to be a stroke is only a one side of the face droop, which is not what the sort of normal person, average Joe, would call a stroke of an older person that loses function, able to walk and talk at the same time. So it actually turns out to be not a stroke, as people think classically, comes in the brain, but a nerve paralysis that's happening outside of the brain.
Okay. So your medical diagnostician sleuth work turned out the diagnosis of?
Meningoencephalitis, likely.
And that is something that we see today, isn't it?
Yes. You'll see it today. You'll see cases of meningitis and encephalitis, or a combination of the two, which would be meningoencephalitis. You won't see it as commonly as you will see strep throat, or you will see scarlet fever, but you definitely see them today.
You kind of have a deeper meaning or deeper message to physicians from your paper in the journal Pediatrics. What does it say to pediatricians about the way parents may receive a diagnosis you hand down?
Right. I mean, I think that this small paper has a lesson for physicians at large, pediatricians and those who deal with children, and in fact, adults as well. And that is that a diagnosis is lived through the patient's eyes, and the perception of what that diagnosis means comes from the patient. Scarlet fever may mean one thing to me. It may mean something else to the patient. While that patient may be technically incorrect in their assumptions and their beliefs about how deadly, for instance, or how dangerous the disease is, it doesn't make them any less real to the patient. And so my job as a physician is to elicit if these belief systems that are maybe incorrect and not accurate with the current day are there, and to, if they are there, to disabuse the patient of them and comfort them in the fact that, for instance, scarlet fever, while it does have its complications, much like strep throat, and it is not a pleasant disease to have, is not the deadly disease that Laura Ingalls Wilder writes about.
Dr. Beth Tarini, University of Michigan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, a new study finds Americans are less healthy than people in many other high-income nations. We'll explore the reasons behind America's health disparities. I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is Stateside on Michigan Radio.